Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? The episode you're about to hear was recorded late Friday evening. It isn't part of our normal weekly lineup, which means you can still expect a new episode to hit your feed on Monday at our usual time of 4 a.m. Eastern Standard. I should also note that nothing I say on this podcast can or should be viewed as financial advice. All opinions expressed by me and my guest are solely our own. This conversation is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for financial decisions. This has been a very stressful time for all of us, and I wanted to make sure that I put out something addressing the fear and uncertainty surrounding the last few weeks. Mike and I don't just discuss markets. We also share our thoughts and feelings about the present moment, what it means for our society, and how the extraordinary measures being undertaken to fight this virus could very well come back to haunt us. It's moments like these where having a platform supported by listeners like you allows me to create content that addresses the issues that matter most. If you could take the time right now to support the show, go to patreon.com/hiddenforces. and become a subscriber. Your support is what makes all of this possible. And with that, please enjoy this special and timely episode with my guest, Mike Green. Mike, welcome to Hidden Forces.
It's great to be back, Dimitri.
Mike is Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager at Logica Capital Advisors. He's an expert on markets. And Mike, I wanted to have you on the program on short notice because of all the stuff that's been going on in markets the last couple of weeks. You had come on in December. We got phenomenal feedback from that episode, and I released the overtime just a few weeks ago. It's been, I think, by far one of the more popular episodes we've put out. And you've put forward a very specific thesis and argument about the transition from active management to passive management. And I felt like, given what we've seen in markets, the crazy price action we've seen the last couple of weeks, and given also the larger macro context of this, which is the coronavirus, as well as, I think it's important to point out, the major shock to the downside to oil prices after the fallout between Saudi Arabia and Russia, I thought it'd be great to bring you on and ask you, what do you make of this? How does this fit into the larger thesis about systematic passive investing that you had put forward on our show back in December?
So, you know, this has been a fascinating time, and there are a number of different markets as you highlighted there. And I think that's actually kind of one of the interesting phenomenon is we've seen this dynamic play out across markets. You know, the work that I talked about with you was primarily focused on the rates markets, the bond markets, and the equity markets. Most people think about passive in the context of the equity markets. There's a significant component that I think has contributed into the bond markets in particular as well. We'll talk about that a little bit. I think it's really important to separate the fundamental factors from the market technicals that allowed the price action that we saw to occur, right? Because we've seen disputes between Russia and Saudi Arabia before. We have seen pandemics before, you know, H1N1, for example. We have seen this stuff happen before with nothing that remotely resembles this market behavior. And part of the reason why I think that happened is not actually because passive sold. The passive investors and the systematic passive investors didn't actually sell. If we look at the data, they continued to buy. But that's actually the paradox, is that they continued to buy in exactly the same quantity. It was as if nothing happened to them. Right. And so when you encountered events that led discretionary investors to increase their selling, there was nobody to step in front and say, okay, I'm going to increase my buying. And that imbalance is what actually happened this past week. Right. Now that's overlaid with some of the other stuff you've heard me talk about with the dynamics around volatility selling, particularly in order to enhance yield. There were some very particular events that occurred in the rates market, to a lesser extent in the equity market, but very, very much in the rates market, we actually saw the dynamics of somebody who had sold derivatives in order to generate increased income and had that trade go very bad, right? And as they got carried out, the impact on that market, the interest rate market, then bled into the credit markets. And so that was kind of the coup de grace that we saw in the last few days.
So can you flesh that out? So they were selling options? They were selling options against interest rate volatility?
Not necessarily against interest rate volatility. Anytime you sell an option, you're selling both a directional component and you're selling a volatility component. The price of the option is determined by those two dynamics. And so by selling the option, you're actually generating premium for yourself. You're receiving a premium payment that you can then pocket as income, assuming nothing goes badly. But when something goes badly, and in this particular case, what you had was participants in the markets had sold low strike receivers, which are derivative instruments that rise in value as interest rates fall, right? So if you've sold that instrument and it rises in value as interest rates fall, the falling interest rates, that rising value creates a payment that you then have to make to your counterparty, requiring you to come up with additional cash. And if that...
So you're insuring against a drop in interest rates? Is that what that is?
You are insuring against a drop in interest rates and you are being paid for that.
Okay.
If it moves far enough against you, it's very much like being an insurer and a hurricane shows up. You need to have enough cash. The way the exchanges work, they monitor your position. If your position becomes too large relative to your underlying credit rating, they can then force you to liquidate that position. And when that liquidation occurred on Friday and to a lesser extent on Monday, what market participants knew was that there was a large quantity of selling of those derivatives that needed to be absorbed. And if you tried to buy a small fraction of that derivative, if you basically put up a partial bid, right, you would create a condition where you knew the next mark was going to be even worse because you had to find somebody else to buy the other piece. And so nobody's really willing to step in front of that. And so when that happens, it creates a cascade of prices because the buyers step away, unwilling to take the potential marks that could cause them to actually face adverse circumstances. And the price needs to fall to a point at which a single large buyer, we don't know who, but a single large buyer basically steps in to clear the trade.
So you're saying that accounts, in your view, for the extraordinary drop in treasury yields?
Correct.
How fast and how far did we drop for people that aren't familiar with what happened over the last few weeks?
Well, it's been underway all year, right? So there has been a dynamic in which people have been talking about the disconnect between the interest rate markets and the equity markets. We started the year with 10-year rates somewhere in the neighborhood of 195. We ended the lows on an intraday basis. I'm actually just looking at it here quickly. The lows on an intraday basis, we got to 31 basis points, so 0.31%. So from basically 2% to 0.31%. The really crazy part is of that move, as of February 18th, we were at 1.6%. And by March 9th, right? So on Monday, March 9th, we hit the low of 0.31%. All right, that's an extraordinary move.
For people that aren't familiar with the bond market, or even people that are, I mean, it's not the easiest thing to understand. How extraordinary is that move?
Well, you know, people often talk about the difficulty in understanding large standard deviation moves, right? And so on a percentage basis, that was give or take about a 7.5 or 8 standard deviation move. There's all sorts of disputes around whether that's a characterization, because there's debates about the normality assumptions, the distribution assumptions. But in really simple terms, when something like that happens, you're literally talking about something that should only happen about once every 100 million years. Seems like that's the wrong way to think about it, but that's roughly what happened.
Hmm. So to make clear, what you're saying is that it wasn't an issue of buyers turning to sellers. The buyers continued to buy, but there was no additional amount of buying to clear the market in the situation where selling became overwhelming. And just the absence of a buyer alone was enough to push prices as far down as we saw them.
Yeah, it was actually, so it's the absence of the incremental buyer, right? And so, you know, if you imagine, we talked, actually, we're seeing a real world example of this right now, right? So grocery stores are currently stocking out all over the country. People are rushing to buy toilet paper. People are rushing to buy water. People are rushing, apparently, to buy frozen foods at Trader Joe's, as you and I were talking about before. And their consumption hasn't actually changed. They're not, to my knowledge, at least, I'd be surprised if they're eating more. I actually would hazard a guess that they're eating less. But they suddenly started buying a whole bunch more. And Trader Joe's or your local grocery store has no way of receiving this signal in advance. The toilet paper manufacturers, Kimberly-Clark and others, have no way of knowing that this is going to occur. And so they just keep manufacturing at the same pace. And when you see this sudden surge in demand where there's buying for inventory, right, it causes a stock out. Suddenly you can't find toilet paper, you can't find eggs, you can't find pasta sauce. Right? That's the exact same thing that happened in the treasury markets, right? The exact same thing that happened in the equity markets. People wanted to sell additional shares, and the large players, the passive investors, they did not receive any change. Remember, the instruction set for the passive player is, did you give me cash? If so, then buy. Did you ask for cash? If so, then sell, right? Because nobody gave them any more cash. They didn't do any more buying. And as a result, supply exceeded demand and prices collapsed.
So I want to ask you two questions here. One is the nature of the response by the Fed, and how effective is that response going to be? And is it going to get the desired results? And then two is kind of a follow-up on that, or it's related to that, which is, we're recording this on Friday, late evening. It's 10 p.m. almost here on the East Coast, Friday, March 13th. Markets closed, I think, almost 10% up from where they were today when they started. I don't know what the low was exactly, but it must be up approximately 10% from the lows. Have we seen an interim bottom here in your estimation?
So I think we've seen the components that were necessary to create an interim bottom, right? When you have these types of forced liquidations, and that's what you had, obviously, in the rates markets on Monday, because once that forced liquidation had occurred, treasuries play a dual role in our financial system. They are both a tool for people to invest in, where they're buying them theoretically for the yield that they're receiving. The other reason that they're buying them, though, is that they function as a hedge. And this is particularly important in products like credit, so corporate bonds, right, where you will hedge your exposure to potential risk-off events. If you want to own a levered bond position, you will use a 10-year interest rate or a 5-year bond to hedge that position, right? When this event occurred, this clearing event occurred, the bonds outperformed dramatically. And so credit investors were very well insulated, far more insulated than they actually thought they should be. But when it began to reverse itself, when prices had cleared, when this single large transaction had cleared, and then prices moved back to the level that they would have normally have been if you weren't trying to carry out this very large transaction, that hedge no longer functioned for the credit markets, right? It ceased working. And when that happened, then the credit investors had to reduce the size of their portfolios. And in the process of reducing their portfolios or seeking out alternate hedges, the traditional hedge, the specific hedge for a credit portfolio is to buy CDS, in particular the IG CDS, the investment grade CDS index. CDS stands for credit default swap, where you are basically betting on the bankruptcy likelihood for an individual company or for a basket of companies. As they sought those alternate hedges and as they reduced the size of their portfolios by selling, that created a separate cascade in the credit default swaps market, where credit defaults began to rise rapidly because there was suddenly increased demand for them. And the bonds themselves were being sold as people reduced the size of their portfolios. That signal is the one that everyone looks for to scare. Like, that's the scary one, right? Because credit investors are supposed to be smarter. Credit investors are supposed to have information about what's going on in the economy. As all of this is happening, right, the Fed is taking this market information, this price action, and it's increasingly adopted the view that this is actually information content, right? The market is sending a signal about the fundamental events in the market. We see this today with people trying to come up with fundamental explanations for why things have fallen so far. JP Morgan today came out and said, you know, well, if earnings fall by 25% and multiples contract, then the market has achieved fair value. Nothing of the sort happened. We have no idea whether earnings are going to fall by 25%. As a matter of fact, if I go to the grocery store and I look at the grocery store shelves, I would suggest that there's a reasonable chance actually that profits are going to be pretty good. Certainly on a forward basis, given the fiscal response that we should anticipate and the cutting of interest rates, right? We actually are potentially looking at a massive amount of stimulus that is coming into the economy in a time period when unemployment's incredibly low, right? On a purely economic standpoint, you should actually see a dramatic surge in the profitability of the corporate sector.
But what about the quarantines that we're seeing beginning to be enacted and the number of people that are going to have to stay at home? How does that impact some of these earnings?
So there are segments of the economy that are absolutely going to see permanent losses of demand, right? Nobody is going to go back and eat two steak dinners in June because they had to skip a steak dinner in March, right? This is not going to happen. But there's many other aspects of the economy, many other components of the economy where that demand is deferred rather than being destroyed, right? And what we're seeing in terms of fiscal stimulus and what we're seeing on a global basis is actually as large as what we saw in 2009. Now, people would debate whether that was big enough or not big enough, right? But the fundamental problem that I would argue is that we're adding this stimulus not at a time where unemployment has been spiking already and we have some certainty about that. What we're actually seeing is the stimulus being debated as unemployment is at record lows and employment is at record highs. And we're already seeing demand for workers in many of these sectors that we're talking about demand being deferred, not destroyed. All right. So you're actually looking at a condition in which, if I'm forecasting forward, yes, there's absolutely going to be a hit in the next month as people go through quarantines. But as we come out of the other side of that, I think there's actually very real risk that we've finally actually established the inflationary conditions that we claim we've wanted. As we're trying to push through demand, we're trying to push through a public sector transfer of income to the private sector, right? In an environment in which we just don't have that much excess capacity.
So is that something that you foresee not just in certain products and services, but also in asset prices, like a melt-up scenario?
Well, the biggest challenge is if you think about the melt-up dynamics, right, what we've talked about, it would literally just be this happening in reverse. So now all the discretionary managers have sold their securities, right? They've reduced their positioning and taken themselves down to a point where they are much less exposed and their positioning is underweight these securities. And those securities have now been transferred primarily to those who have very strong hands or, more accurately, disinterested hands, right? Vanguard and BlackRock and funds that are being held for a very, very long period of time. I think there's a very real risk that we actually discover that there's an extraordinary shortage of securities that emerges in the same language that people use to describe risk-free interest, you know, the government bonds, right? That there's a shortage of riskless assets, right? That's why people think these prices are so low. Now, I think there's all sorts of problems with the way that we think about this and the way that we approach this. Right, the idea that the Federal Reserve is stimulating on a short-term basis by cutting interest rates in the presence of a global pandemic is somewhat absurd. As you're pointing out, we're moving into an environment in which people are very rapidly going into a lockdown mode. And so there's no scenario in which somebody is going to actually increase their borrowing to increase their consumption or increase their capital spending over the next month. Right, this is at best going to be a very slow impact on the economy by reducing borrowing costs. It may forestall the occasional bankruptcy, right? And it may provide, and we're seeing this in more direct mode as we talk about fiscal support that effectively is saying nobody gets foreclosed on. We extend credit to those who would otherwise have trouble generating cash flow, right? So cash flow is very different than income. Cash flow is where a transaction actually occurs. You receive cash for the goods that you sold. Again, the goods have been cleared out, right? Lots of cash has flowed into the hands of shopkeepers and retailers around the United States, right? The incomes will be hit, but the cash flow is extraordinarily strong. And then we'll see that in reverse as we restock and we rebuild up. But that's economic stimulus. To build up that supply takes economic activity, right? That takes workers. And all of this is happening at the same time that we've had a very real discussion for the first time about the importance of restructuring the supply chains of the United States so that we're not so reliant upon China.
Hmm.
Right, so we're looking at a situation, in my opinion, that is potentially very inflationary and very stimulative. Now, that's my opinion, and obviously it's in the future, but I think it highlights the other dynamic, which is that there's a very real separation between the price action and the potential economic outcomes. And yet increasingly, we live in a world in which our policymakers react to the financial sector's price signals, the change in prices of securities, as if that's actually conveying economic information. And increasingly, it's not. It's conveying the technical positioning and the technical behavior of the market participants.
So what would be an example of that, for instance, with respect to Treasury yields? When the Fed sees interest rates on the 10-year collapse to 0.4, whatever, 0.38, what are they interpreting that that's saying? And what is the underlying reality of what's driving that impact?
Well, I think there's a couple of different components, right? So one of the things, in this particular example, the Fed sees a collapse in those interest rates. And their assumption is that there is a race for safe assets, right? People are dumping risky assets and racing for safe assets, with the idea being that all hell is breaking loose and people are seeking safety. As I actually just highlighted, what we saw in the rates market, at least on Friday and Monday, was not somebody seeking safety. It was somebody who had sold risk and saw that position turn against themselves and then were being forced to cover. And so it was perceived as a signal for safety was actually a signal of a risk trade gone wrong, right?
One of the things that you've talked about with me is the role of passively constructed bond indices and the allocation of bond ETFs and how that actually has this perverse impact as rates drop on the long end, that an intervention by the Fed on the short end actually causes the yield curve to invert further, even though the Fed is trying to steepen the curve.
Right. So what you're referring to is there's a dynamic called the yield curve, and it is the spread between longer dated bonds and shorter dated bonds. There's a variety of flavors. The most common one that people will quote is what's called the 10s to spread. And so that is the interest rate of 10-year bonds subtracting the interest rate of 2-year bonds. When that is steep, i.e. when that number is high, right? So 10-year bonds are yielding much more than 2-year bonds. That tends to be perceived as an indicator of strong economic growth, inflationary conditions in the future that would cause interest rates to have to go higher as policy resets to accommodate a much more aggressive economic event in the future, right? So that's perceived as a very positive signal. When that number becomes very low or becomes negative and 10-year bonds are trading below 2-year bonds, that's a classic recession signal, right? The idea being that the world is saying, I'm much more interested in protecting myself from a period of slow activity in the future, right? Therefore, I'm buying a longer duration bond that would allow me to last through this time period. The problem is that there's two ways that that can happen. That can happen because of the discretionary activities of an active manager, or it can happen because of the mechanical dynamics of a passive index construction. And so I'm going to illustrate this in a really simple way. Imagine you have a bond index that simply has two separate bonds, 10-year bond and a 2-year bond. They're equal weighted in the index at the start, right? So 50% of the index is 2-year bonds and 50% of the index is 10-year bonds. When the Fed cuts interest rates, it has a very interesting effect. The yield on the 2-year falls more, right? Because a 2-year bond typically has 4 coupons associated with it that happen semi-annually. And so that interest rate cut is going to be a greater fraction of the interest payments that are received over that time period. And so the 2-year bond's interest rate falls more than the 10-year does. But the 10-year bond has what's called higher duration or higher sensitivity to interest rates. And so while its yield may fall less initially than the 2-year bond, its price actually rises more. Right? And so after the Fed cuts the interest rate, the 2-year bond and the 10-year bond and their weights in the index have shifted so that there's now more demand for buying the 10-year bond. That more demand to buy the 10-year bond in turn forces the price of that 10-year bond higher, which is just another way of saying its yield goes lower. And so that relationship, the 10s versus 2s spread, over time is pushed lower by passive players, by passive index construction. As new money comes in, it's buying more of the 10 than of the 2. And that causes the yield curve to flatten. And the Fed then interprets that as a signal that things aren't so good. And so what does the Fed do when things aren't so good? It cut interest rates. That causes more demand for the 10 than for the 2. And so the yield curve flattens further. In 2019, we saw something we'd never seen before. And I think this is a contributing factor to what transpired this year. Right? So the Fed cut interest rates 3 times in 2019. From a macro investor standpoint, the Fed cutting interest rates is a classic sign of stimulus. And as a result, you expect the 10s to spread to steepen, the yield on the 10-year to be higher relative to the yield on the 2-year. Right? But what we actually saw in 2019 was for the first time in history, every single time the Fed cut interest rates, the 10-2 spread flattened, suggesting that the Fed was getting further and further behind the curve, that the conditions were deteriorating. Now, of course, it's ironic because stock markets were screaming over this time period, right? But that flattening of the yield curve was something that really threw a lot of macro investors for a loop. I know of several that were very aggressive in deploying what are called steepeners, right? And a steepener is just another way of saying, I'm betting that the yield on the 10-year is going to fall more slowly than the yield on the 2-year. In other words, they've sold insurance on the 10s. I actually think that was a primary driver of this blow up that we saw last week or this week. Feels like last week already, right? It was macro investors that didn't understand, hadn't taken the time to learn about the index construction. Instead, functionally were lazy and said, I think the historical relationships governed this dynamic, right? And they got blown up.
So where do you think we're going right now? Where is this market going? And not to give financial advice, because this is not financial advice, but what does an individual investor do in this type of a situation?
Well, the first piece of advice I would give people is, definitely what I call adult swim, right? So this is not, you know, this is not the environment in which you should be playing around and speculating. I've invested, you know, the better part of 30 years of my life to try to figure out how to be right half the time in this market. And so it's not something that I'm going to give anyone advice on how they trade it. The challenge is that I think that we are in a bubble, and I think that that bubble is being driven by the construction techniques of passive investing, right? Their influence on the market. And so the challenge you have to address is that the risk, the bias that you have towards the markets is that they will go up, but they're going to go up in an increasingly fragile, or the technical term would be inelastic manner. Right? You're going to see behavior in which rising prices, exactly as we're talking about with 10-year bonds, rising prices actually encourages people to buy more. In Bitcoin terms, they're going to HODL. That's what's going on. And if you see that type of dynamic, then you need to seek out ways to play it through leverage, but that leverage has to be non-recourse. Right? And what I mean by that is, if the bet goes wrong, you're able to walk away with no penalty.
So by non-recourse leverage, you're talking about buying a call option, for example, a leveraged long position to play the melt up so that you have a limited downside.
Yeah, I mean, so a really simple example, you know, the S&P index currently after today's action is, you know, trading at 2711. As you point out, up from an intraday low just yesterday of 2478, right? So we've seen, you know, nearly a 240 point move in the S&P. And by the way, 170 points of that occurred in the last 30 minutes of trading today, right? To give you some idea, like the fragility, the crazy dynamic that's actually happening out there. You know, if I were to look at buying a call option on the S&P 500, and again, I am in no way suggesting that anyone should do anything like this, but if I were to look at buying an S&P call option for the next month, so we've got a April 17th expiry, you know, that at-the-money call option is going to cost you somewhere around $160. Now, the most you can lose is the $160. Your probability of actually making that, right, making that back, it would require the markets to rise somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.5% over the course of the next month. That's an extraordinary rate of return, right? That translates to somewhere around 70% a year. And so the high levels of volatility right now make that very difficult to execute that type of trade. But that is non-recourse leverage, because in the crazy situation in which the market went up 10% a day every day, as it did today, you know, if that kept happening, you would have a giant position in terms of notional, and the most you could lose is the premium that you expended. Right? Now, again, this is super adult swim, because the high probability is you're going to lose the vast majority of that $160, right? This is not what I'm advising anyone to do, and it's certainly not what we're doing at Logica. But that is a good example of non-recourse leverage. Another good example of non-recourse leverage would be a variant of a home mortgage in the housing bubble, in which you could buy a house with zero down and mail in the keys to the bank, right? If the trade turned against you, you could mail in the keys to the bank. Now, where you lose in that trade is because it negatively affects your credit rating, and it would end up hurting your ability to access credit in the future. So there is a recourse component to that, largely in terms of your ability to access future leverage. But that's a great example of how leverage is used to both fuel and play in a bubble.
Right? The point being, the only thing you'd lose is the down payment. And also, options market is a much more liquid market than the real estate market, obviously.
Right. That's exactly correct. I think that actually gives us a clue, though, in terms of both what has happened and what is likely to happen going forward, because we didn't see anyone sell. Right. And most of the people that, unfortunately, were talking about losing their jobs are lower income service workers who may lose it on a temporary basis and certainly will have adverse effects on them. And there may be some small businesses that come under tremendous pressure from that dynamic. The types of relief and how that is targeted to them will influence that outcome. But for the most part, those who can work from home and tend to fit the characteristic of a reasonably high income white collar worker, they're going to continue putting their money into their 401ks, right? That money is going to continue to flow into the passive vehicles. And so the irony of this type of event is that it could, just as we saw in 2018, end with prices very rapidly moving potentially even higher than they just were.
And on top of that, we're going to have massive fiscal stimulus. It isn't just what you're saying. It's in the context of massive fiscal stimulus.
Right. I mean, again, think about one form that that fiscal stimulus could take, right? An incentive for corporations to increase their matching of employee 401ks, right? So more money goes into the stock market in the form of passive investing. I don't know that this is going to happen, and I want to be really clear about that, but I think the possibility of it happening is something that those who have not really stopped to understand what's happening in a purely technical basis, they're still operating very much like I would argue our regulators are operating. They're looking at their prices and they're trying to say, what is the economic signal here? What is the fundamental signal that is coming to us? And I think that's unfortunately an increasingly crazy way to look at the system.
So I want to ask you something else, and feel free to answer whatever you feel comfortable discussing. Because I've thought, you know, obviously there's the market component, and within that, this discrepancy between the economic reality and the financial picture and what regulators are looking at and how their reactions are actually, in some cases, having, in the case of the bond market, having a positive feedback loop. Like I used an example with you in one of our prior discussions, like that guy who was pressing on the gas in the Toyota thinking he was hitting on the brake and he was actually accelerating when he was trying to slow down. On the flip side, or on a parallel track, there is one, I guess, this thing about the mask quarantine. I think in the context of this quarantine and to the point about the shortfall in income, it creates, I think, a need for some of those people, but it also creates an impetus to see a major government reaction, whether it is on the healthcare front, whether it is on the fiscal stimulus, UBI, for example, in this country. We've been talking about that for a while. I mean, if there was an opportunity to do UBI, it seems to me like this is the best opportunity yet. And I think also there's something else which I've been thinking a lot about, which is, what does this period remind me of? And yes, there is the 2008 period. It reminds me of, not in terms of being a credit crisis or a banking crisis, but certainly in the fact that we're seeing some of the panic expressed in asset prices and a huge decline in equity markets. But there's also 9/11 and the post-9/11 period, and that was really, I think, what's similar there is this existential event surrounded by death and people's fear of death. But neither one of those is exactly correct. And I feel like the big difference is that 9/11, as well as 2008, though I would say the faith in government had begun to deteriorate after 9/11, after the invasion in Iraq and the failure of that reconstruction, I feel like today we're operating in an environment where trust in institutions is much lower than at any time in my living memory. At the same time that we are conditioned, we've been conditioned to need these institutions more than ever before, and in a situation where we actually need them right now. And so I feel like this is one of the really big differences, and I think it's expressed in our politics. I think, not to be political, but I think that Donald Trump is an expression of this. I think you and I may have talked about this, or I may have been having this conversation with somebody else, I'm not sure. But I think Donald Trump is, in a sense, an expression of the loss of faith in the elite or the experts of society. And we are heading into an election. We're heading into an election when people are going to be in quarantine. We're heading into an election when the top two presidential candidates on the Democratic ticket, on the Democratic side, are 79 and 77 years old. And I'm willing to point out something that I think is rather obvious to everyone, and it's something I think we all talk about in private, but it's something that I've felt very uncomfortable talking about in public, and that is that when you look at someone like Joe Biden, he hasn't looked well for the last few years. And I just worry, you know, to come back to 9/11, you know, after the 9/11 attacks, we got the Patriot Act, we got the authorization to use for the use of military force. 2008, we had the rolling bailouts. Now we're having an emergency declaration. I'm not sure what's going to come all of that. And at the same time, you could argue we're in an environment where there has been and there continues to be a level of information warfare, not just between countries, but within countries. There's massive social discord. And we're heading into an election where two candidates are out walking all around, meeting people in giant crowds when we're being told by CDC guidance to avoid crowds of any size, let alone campaign rallies. And these people are in the highest risk demographic, and they are our two presidential candidates. And so is the president, by the way. You know, I feel like this is a giant cluster, you know what? And I guess I just wanted to throw that out for you and just ask you, what do you do as an investor, as a person? How do you incorporate that risk into your model?
Well, so first of all, I think you raised some very, very good points. Like you, I'm drawn to the 9/11 analogy. I think it's very easy for people to forget how fractured things felt at that point, how many of the assumptions that we had as members of society had been shaken. And it's easy to talk about 9/11, but we forget the immediate aftermath of that. We had the anthrax mailings, right? We had the introduction of TSA, right? There were extraordinary disruptions that occurred, you know, Homeland Security, et cetera. There are extraordinary disruptions that occurred all over the place. I don't think we've actually experienced anything quite like this. And, you know, you and I have talked often about the concept of learned helplessness, right? This is one of these dynamics where we watch the price action in markets because we presume somebody else knows more than we do, right? And so we're taking signals from those. As a matter of fact, our regulators, our appointed officials in charge of the price of money, the Federal Reserve, increasingly looks to the markets for information about what is happening in the world at the exact same time that the behavior in those markets is increasingly governed by passive investors and the technical behavior that I've been describing up to this point. And so it's, in a weird way, I don't think that there's a great analogy. I don't think that there is something in our immediate past. I'm much more drawn to, you know, the chaotic scenes of the movie, The Ten Commandments, where, you know, Charlton Heston is Moses and he's called down the plagues upon the Pharaoh, who in the form of Yul Brynner is standing there, you know, his back very straight and refusing to give in to this heathen until the people panic, right? Until the firstborn sons die, right? This is biblical, right? People are terrified. And so we're forced into action. And the problem is those actions themselves are using signals that, as I described to you, are like driving with a funhouse mirror as your rearview mirror, right? You're looking in the back and you're, you know, that's the only way that you can possibly drive. And you're basically seeing a distorted image of what's actually happening, right? And so instead of vol dampening, instead of contracyclical policy that has the potential to dampen and improve conditions, I think increasingly, just as I described in the treasury market, we're engaged in activity that is reinforcing the panic.
Okay, so where does that lead us?
Well, I think that's part of what's so terrifying to me about the dynamics of electing someone like, you know, we'll use the 77-year-old and the 79-year-old as shorthand components, right? But you're talking about putting somebody in office who very few people expect can capably actually handle that at the same time that we're saying, oh my God, we need that person more than ever, right? And so what does that naturally lead to? That naturally leads to a battle of control behind the scenes, right? Somebody is going to be making the decisions because we have a figurehead in place, right? You know, I agree with you. I'm terrified for it. And I alluded to this in our prior discussions that I think what we're watching is a period that is leading to the end of our democratic system, whether we call it that, right? I mean, Augustus Caesar called himself the first citizen and, like Putin, pretended to be elected, right? It pretended to go through all the motions of having the citizens and the Senate bless him. But what he knew was actually going on, just as in Putin's Russia, is that if you stood up against him or you protested, you'd quietly find yourself shipped off with booksellers to China. That's the dynamic that we appear to be moving towards. And the only way we can fight that is for everyone to take personal responsibility. And that's just hard, right? Because we ourselves are increasingly operating under the uncertainty of, do I believe what I'm seeing with my own eyes, right? I'm seeing prices crash. I'm seeing my wealth evaporate in the form of my 401k turning into a 201k. Right, I know that something is terrible and is happening, right? And that's really hard to deal with. It's really hard to deal with. I feel fortunate in some ways that I'm in the position that I'm in because I've had to deal basically my entire investment life with looking at signals that are coming from the market and making the choice, do I think the signals are wrong or do I think I'm wrong? Right, and in order to make a decision and to believe that I have edge, I have to have the hubris to say, I think the signals are wrong. Right. And so I'm much more comfortable doing that, I think, than most people are. But I think we all need to start doing that. We all need to start saying in some way, shape, or form, you know, what do I actually believe in? Right. What am I trying to achieve with this? And that's not, it's not easy to do. Right. And as a society, I think it's far easier when you, you know, start by getting on a boat and traveling across, you know, risky seas in a 3-month voyage to travel to a new world in which you could, you know, have your life taken from you by disease and solitude and unfriendly natives, right? Those who choose to bear that responsibility in the first place are probably more equipped for those types of decisions. We're a very different society today.
Am I following you correctly in what you're saying is that the majority of the population, because of this point about learned helplessness, they are conditioned and looking for a savior?
Absolutely. I mean, again, that is exactly what Augustus did.
Right.
Right. I mean, Augustus literally took advantage of the appearance of Halley's Comet to claim that that was Caesar ascending into heaven. And since he was the adopted son of Caesar, he clearly had, they didn't call it heaven at that time, obviously, but, you know, he clearly had divine right. He was the chosen offspring, the chosen heir of a divine individual, establishing divinity for himself. And he was going to be the one to bring back Rome, right? That's what we're looking for. Make America great again.
So here's a question. The person in charge currently who's sitting in the White House, who heads up the executive branch, does not seem well either. it seems to me, my opinion, that all three candidates that are available that are on offer to be president of the United States in 2020, whether it's the current occupant or it's whether it's one of the two main rivals, not any one of these seem up to the task even of being a false prophet. And I think you seem to kind of be hinting at that by talking about, well, it'll be someone behind the scenes. I mean, can you be more specific about how you envisage this? Because to me, I'll tell you, I don't quite know. But what does keep me up at night, what worries me, is that everyone's focused on coronavirus right now and on equity markets. But there are a gazillion and a half risks in the world, things that could go wrong, enemies of the United States, adversaries that see themselves as geopolitical adversaries, that could either by design or by mistake act in some way during this period. We saw a potential small example of that with Iran being blamed for the attack against the Iraqi base that killed two American servicemen and I think one Brit. I mean, you could see any number of other things go wrong, and then we find ourselves in a much deeper crisis amid this situation with coronavirus. That's what worries me the most. But how does this all work in terms of leadership and people and false prophets?
Well, I mean, look, I would be ridiculous if I told you how this is going to happen, right? So I'm not going to speculate on the actual mechanics in which it's going to happen. I would simply say that we have a number of historical examples across a variety of, you know, nation states, city states, et cetera, where power has been wielded behind the scenes with an incompetent leader, right? We had it in the United States with Woodrow Wilson, right, who had had a stroke and was incapable of actually functioning. So we've been here before. And the question is just, are we in the process of seeking immediacy to our problems, right? Immediate solutions to our problems? Are we degrading the systems that have allowed the system to resist that to this point? And unfortunately, you and I talked about this, like for me, there's a mixture of sadness where I watch things that I have been worried about happening as I see the structure and I see similar narratives and similar events playing out in other structures that exhibit similar types of fragility and that we're enhancing that fragility by our increased reliance, right? I mean, of course, now is the time that everybody wants universal basic income. So if we put it in, what happens? Well, do you protest against the government that pays your paycheck? Do you run the risk of interrupting that stream of universal basic
this is a great point because you're a market structure guy and this is political structure. What you're describing is a post-UBI environment. What impact would the actual income, the check that you're getting every month from the government, what impact would that have on your voting behavior and on your political activism and what you want? Absolutely. I mean, no one seems to be talking about the permanent impact and damage, quite frankly, that would have on Republican democracy.
I think that's exactly the point.
Yeah. So look, Mike, I appreciate you doing this. You know, as you know, I like to prep, and this is a situation where I couldn't. I've been working all day and just recorded another session with David Kilcullen, which is going to come out as a full episode. I'm really appreciative of you taking the time, man. You know how much I respect your thoughts and how much I rely on them to understand what's going on in the market.
Well, I was glad to help, and despite the lack of prep, I think you did a fantastic job. So I look forward to chatting with everyone again.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.